just a hunk of metal to them. That does not mean, however, that ghosts are not subject to being bound. They are typically bound to a space near where they died, albeit by intangible spiritual tethers rather than anything tied to the earth. For me to escape her, all I had to do was escape the building. Or so I thought. As I pelted through the hall and then down the grand staircase leading to the exit, all manner of papers and books and dust devils followed me along with her screams. I got a textbook to the temple at one point and fell down, but scrambled back up again, staggering a bit. She chased me right out the door in rather shockingly immodest display, and then, much to my horror, kept going. Now that she'd found her Nigel, she had moored herself to me and unchained herself from the building. I had to skedaddle, which I think is the best possible word for getting the hell out when a poltergeist thinks you've jilted her. Where the university's law library is now, there used to be a giant old oak that I had tethered to Tirnanog, and I used that to shift away to safety and do some research on who or what she was. Later on, I shifted back in and waited to be attacked, but Gwendolyn the poltergeist wasn't lurking by the oak. She had probably returned to the building she had haunted before. But there was no way I was returning to check. I picked up what few things I had at my lodgings and took off before she could locate me again. Never to return to Toronto. Until today.
So, that Gwendolyn Lady in Red could still be out there right now?
Oberon said as I rinsed him off. Yep.
And she could still be very mad at Nigel?
Yep. She appears to have quite the impressive memory for a ghost.
And you're gonna dress up as Nigel Hargrave again on purpose?
That's right. Except this time I will try to be her Nigel instead of the pre-med student she mistook for him. She's capable of talking. She has things she desperately wants to say to Nigel, you see. And I have something I need to say, too.
Oh, you should sing her a love song. Music soothes the savage ghost.
That's breast, Oberon. Savage breast, not savage ghost. William Congreve wrote the original line, and he gets misquoted a lot.
Well, it's no wonder I've never met a savage breast. With the tasty ones, yeah, fried up and covered in gravy. But never savage.
You've been a good hound in the bath. Let's get you dried off and feed you a sausage or two.
Chapter 4. Few things chop me tits worse than big cities. Smelly things choked with cars, and the horizon choked with big rectangular signs telling people to buy newer cars. I says to Greta, I love it when you kick me arse, but this city's doing it in a way I can't fight back. This Paradise Valley of yours is no paradise to me, love. I simply can't live here in this feckin' wasteland of concrete and cactus. I need me trees. And God's bless her, she says she'll move to the country with me. Sort of.
How would Flagstaff be?
She says.
We'll live on the San Francisco peaks, with all those pines and aspens, and we can go into town when necessary.
That sounds dodgy to me. When would it ever be necessary? I asks her.
Well, we'd have to get food once in a while.
Why go to the city for that? We can hunt and grow our own, get some sheep and goats and chickens.
All right, Owen. If you want to do that, I suppose it's possible.
It's more than possible. It's the only way to live. She smiles at me, and I feel hope again.
Then I'll transfer myself over to the Flagstaff pack, she says. It's far past time for me to pick up and move on. And Sam and Ty are good guys.
Aye, good sparring partners, I says. The leaders of the Flagstaff Pack are younger wolves than Hal Hawk and much of his crew in Tempe. But they're a happy couple. Share their beer, and don't mind going a few rounds with a bear every so often. Truth be told, I'd rather go back to Ireland, but I can't ask Greta to do that. She needs a pack to run with when the moon is full, and I'm not sure they have one over there. A lot of business with something called a realtor happens after that. They have people these days who do nothing but sell houses, and they aren't even the ones who built them. Makes no feckin' sense. Here, says I to Greta. Here's this field full of prairie dogs I found, and it has a shack to shite in. I'll sell it to ye for stupid money, eh? Is that how this realtor thing works?
More or less, except it's the owner of the shack who puts it up for sale, not the realtor.
Well, then why do you need the realtor person?
Lots of legal reasons, and it prevents the buyer and the seller from getting into fights.
Oh, well, I can understand that, then. I bought some bad venison once from a man who lived in a bog, and I wanted to pound the piss out of him. Should have had a realtor do it for me. Oh, that would have been handy.
No, Owen, that's not what realtors do.
Well, they feckin' should. There's all manner of men living in bogs who need a good thrashing, and I bet there's people who would pay. Hmm? Could be a full-time job. Maybe it should be my job. Sheehan says I'm supposed to have one. Greta gives up trying to explain realtors after that, and I stop asking. I just let her handle the modern horror of it all. She finds a place outside city limits, which suits me fine, with plenty of tree-dotted land attached to it, and a house that's way too big, but she says it'll come in handy. Handy for what? I asks. I don't need a feckin' castle.
You might, she replies. I have no earthly idea what she means. And she says to wait, she wants to sit me down with Hal and Sam and Ty and talk through something. The sit-down comes a couple of days later at Sam and Ty's house when Hal drives up special from Tempe. They give me fancy beer and smile a bit too wide. They have cheese you can spread on crackers and clearly expect me ancient mind to be destroyed by the sheer cleverness of the idea. They must want to ask me to do them a favor, and they're afraid I'll say no.
All right, what is it then? I says. If you're going to try to convince me to get one of those cell phones, you might as well give up now.
No, nothing like that, Owen, Greta says. As far as we know, this is something you actually want.
All right. I'm listening. I sink into a brown leather couch, and it sucks away at me backside like it'll never let me rise again.
From things you've said to me, I believe it's your wish to train additional druids.
Right. Not sure where I'll find parents to let me do that, though. These people don't believe in magic, and if they do, they don't want their kids involved in it.
Well, there are some parents who do believe in magic, and would like their kids to be druids very much.
There are?
Yes. Parents who are werewolves.
What's that, no? I thought she couldn't have kids. The transformation would kill the baby every time.
That's correct, but there are a few recently turned wolves around the world who had children before they were bitten, and of course they're worried about them. They don't want their kids to become wolves, but neither do they want their kids to feel excluded from their lives. They see druidry as a perfect compromise. Their kids can remain in the magical world and even run with packs once they can shapeshift, but they never have to live with the curse of lycanthropy.
How young are we talking?
Let me ask instead, what would be the ideal age?
6 to 8. They absorb languages easier when they're young, and I can shape their minds to handle headspaces much better than if you start later. That way they'd be bound to the earth when they're 18 to 20, I says. The wolves exchange a glance, and it's Hal Hauk who speaks next.
We know of 6 children who fit that range. If you're agreeable, we'll have their parents transfer to the Flagstaff pack, and then you can be in charge of their instruction going forward.
Well, hold on a minute now. I try to sit forward on the couch and it fights me. I have to paw at the damn armrest to pull myself up. Yeah. You're suggesting I start a grove here in Flagstaff, on Greta's land?
Why not, Owen? Greta says. We have the space, we have privacy, we have lots of trees on the property, and you can build what structures you want in addition to what's already there. A greenhouse, maybe for herbs and vegetables?
6 apprentices at once, with the full support and resources of the werewolves, huh? It sounds suspiciously good. These kids haven't been bitten, right? You can't bind them to Gaia if they've been bitten.
No, they're perfectly normal in every way.
Hal assures me.
It's just their parents who are different.
Once they're bound, you know, they can't ever be affected by a bite. Gaia won't let them turn into werewolves. It's why I can spar with ye without fear.
That's a definite plus as far as we're concerned,
Greta says. They'll be vulnerable until then, mind.
We understand. Strict safety measures will be in effect. They already are.
Well then, I says, I'm not opposed. Smiles break out, and I hold up a hand to stop them. But don't get too excited, and don't do anything yet. We don't want to start something like this if Sheahan is going to come along and cock it all up. I haven't heard from him or Granuaile in a while, and I should make sure they know to leave me alone from now on. Hal's face suddenly looks tired, but he nods.
Probably best. You're right. I know he's worried about vampires right now. I am too, I suppose. One that used to work with us claimed the entire state as his territory. I don't think he would mess with us, but should he decide to turn nasty, it could be quite disastrous.
Aye. So we'll be cautious. I'll check in with Tiernanog. Briet has already given me her blessing in general to start training druids, but I would like to get her specific blessing on this. We may enjoy the protection of the Fae as well as that of the pack. Greta leaps up from her seat and pounces on me, pressing her mouth to mine and returning me to the clutches of the leather couch.
Thank you for considering it, Owen. It means a lot to us.
She is warm, and her hair smells like berries and vanilla, and her breath comes quicker as we kiss. And then she rears back and twists me nipple hard before backing away to the door, a wicked smile on her face.
Run with me, teddy bear,
she says, using that nickname she thinks is cute but still confuses me. I am nothing like a teddy bear. If I can ever get out of this thrice-damned couch, I will, I says. But before Greta can bolt out the door, someone knocks on it. She opens it, and a voice asks for me. Who would be asking for me here? I wonder aloud, and struggle to get up. Damn this fucking couch, Sam! Take an ox to it and setting on fire already! Laughing, he extends an arm to me and says,
I can't do that. It's Ty's favorite.
Ty looks wounded, and I feel like an ox box for making it happen. Sorry, Ty. Never mind me. I'm an ornery shite. Take it out of me hide next time we spar. Defend the honor of your arse-munching couch. The man at the door is Crenia, one of the two of the Danann. He has a couple of flat wooden boxes under his arm, and he smiles when he sees me. Ah, Owen, I'm glad I caught you. Braid said this would be a likely place to look. She did? Well, I guess she's been watching me more carefully than I thought. What can I do for you? Just accept these. I finished your knuckles, and I have some gifts from Lukta as well. Me knuckles? I'd forgotten all about them. Crania had taken measurements of me fists and promised to fashion some kind of weapon for me as a personal test of his skill.
I hadn't asked for him. He'd volunteered. I suppose that the Tuatha Dé Danann are longing for glory again, now that there are druids in the world once more. I mean, more druids than Sheahan, who is in hiding for 2,000 years. Aye, can't wait to see you try them on. Have you a minute to spare, or have I come at a terrible time? Greta catches me eye.
We can run later, Owen, she says, but expect a rough one.
I'm looking forward to it, I reply. Then I tell Crania he's welcome and introduce him to all the wolves. Ty fetches him a bear and I raise my bottle. To Govnew and his craft, I says, remembering his brother, killed by a spriggan during Fan's attempted coup on Breit. Not a day goes by I don't miss him. We drink to his memory, and then, at Sam's invitation, Crania sets down his boxes on their dining room table. One is larger than the other, but both are custom-varnished maple. Crania opens the smaller of the two, and the interior is lined with red felt. A set of brass knuckles rests inside, etched with bindings that the god of craft cannot wait to explain. They haven't been named yet, but these are weapons worthy of a name, he says. Unbreakable, amplifies your strength, and serves as a power reservoir for Gaia's energy. What do you mean by that? Well, Sheahan and Granuel both have something similar. You may find yourself cut off from the earth at times in this modern world and need some juice for a binding. You can store some in these knuckles and draw on it as needed. Sheahan has a silver bear charm and Granuel stores hers in the silver end of Scourja. They chose silver in case they had reason to worry about werewolves. His eyes dart to his hosts, suddenly aware that he might be given offence. He hurries on. Well, bronze can store that energy too. These knuckles can each store more than both of those combined. Well, that makes me happier than a swim in a pool of barter. What happens when I shapeshift, though? That's the best part. They shift with you and adapt to your forms. When you're a bear, they encase your claws. When you're a ram, they cover your horns. When you're a walrus, they coat your tusks. And when you're a kite, they move to your talons. Oh, you're just showing off for your brother now, aren't you?
Perhaps a little,
he says, proud and pleased.
The great drawback to Scourge is that Granuel has to find a way to carry it, no matter what her form is. Tremendously powerful weapon otherwise. The invisibility binding is incredible. But she can't shape-shift efficiently with it. In practical terms, she's tied to her human form. I didn't want you to have to worry about that. These will morph with you and always be useful.
May I try them?
Please, do. I would love to see them in action.
I pluck them out of the felt and slip them on over my fingers. They're cool against the skin and fit perfectly. I note that they're thin, but wide, covering the space between first and second knuckles. I don't feel any different while I'm wearing them, but I expect that'll change once I get outside and charge them up. Very nice. Let's go outside and give a boulder a bad day. Flagstaff's at 7,000 feet, and it lets you know it in December. It hadn't snowed yet, but it is certainly cold enough for it. That doesn't matter. I strip to my skin as soon as I get outside and feel the rush of energy flow up from the tattoo on the sole of my foot. I don't draw too much. It isn't necessary. I'm just taking the knuckles out for a test punch. An innocent chunk of rust-coloured stone that had never done anything to me is my first target, sticking up out of the pine needles about 30 yards away from Sam and Toy's house. Will I scratch these, or damage them by hitting rocks and walls and things?
They should be fine, Grania says.
And me hands?
Should also be fine.
Normally I wouldn't bother punching a stone. Your fingers would break long before the stone would, and rock doesn't make any noises to let you know it's hurt.
But if you're going to test a weapon, you have to do it right. I cock me right fist, half expecting to shatter me hand, and let one fly at the rock. It doesn't split and turn to dust, but neither does me hand. Instead, the blow turns the top layer underneath the knuckles into a fine webwork of crazed lines, and I feel nothing but fine and powerful. Encouraged, I follow up with a combo, more muscle behind the punches this time, and chips fly from the stone. Holy shit, Owen, Greta says. Are your hands okay? I show them to her. No blood, no redness signaling an oncoming bruise. Perfectly fine! I shift to a bear with the knuckles on to see what happens. The brass flows, stretching and shaping itself to me claws. I have brass bear claws! I swipe at the ground with one of them, expecting resistance from the half-frozen, dried-up clay soil, but it scoops away like cottage cheese. Incredible! I shift to a walrus next just to see the brass on me tusks. I can feel the brass move and flow up me hands to me face as I shift. And then there they are, gleaming brass-coated tusks. I bellow at Crania and the wolves to make them laugh. And then I skip the ram form and shift to a red kite. The middle moves from face to feet, and my talons are still very sharp and covered in the brass. Curious as to how the extra weight will affect me flight, I take wing and note that lifting off the ground requires just a bit more effort. But once airborne, I don't perceive a difference. Additional strength flows from the brass into me wing muscles, and there's no strain. To test the talons, I light on a ponderosa tree branch and nearly snap it off. Oh, they will require a light touch then, when I'm wearing them, or else I'll damage trees unintentionally. It's a fine gift, far beyond anything I deserve, and I glide to another branch and land gently on it to get control of myself. Kite's tear ducts aren't easily triggered by emotions, so it's a good farm for me to have some feelings without leaking them everywhere. It's been a fine day, what with the possibility of having shiny new apprentices and some knuckles to beat the shite out of a deserving man in a bog somewhere, plus the promise of a run with Greta later. It's more bounty than I could reasonably expect, more than I ever enjoyed in my old life. I really owe Sheahan for days like this. Damn his eyes. When I fly down and shift to my human form again, I take off the knuckles and bury Crenian praise. You are the finest craftsman alive! They're wonderful! Perfect! The son of Breit bows in thanks. I trust you'll do something properly legendary with them. If you don't make yourself famous with those, the effort's entirely wasted. I'm sure something will come along, I says, grinning at him. When you name them, you let me know, won't you? Of course, of course. I have one more thing for you, and then I'll take me leave. Oh, right, there's another box. We pile inside and I put me clothes back on to warm up. The larger box from Lacta holds 3 wooden stakes, hardwood beauties carved with bindings. Lacta heard that Sheahan has human going after vampires and is trying to make the world safe for druids, so he made these for the 3 of you. Hold on a moment now, I says. Sheahan's doing what? My understanding is that the vampires have declared open season on druids again. All 3 of you. They were the ones who spared the Romans to wipe you out, you know, back in the old days, that I guess you missed, and only Sheahan survived. And you, of course, by skipping past it all. I didn't know that. He never told me that. Greta breaks in and says, I thought he told you everything while you were touching up his tattoo. No, no, he must have left out that part. Mostly he talked about cocking up with the gods, and there's only one vampire he talked about. No?
Two? One almost killed him because the first one betrayed him.
Right. That was Leif Helgerson who betrayed him.
I'll says.
He betrayed us as well.
What is this old vampire named Theophilus who's out for your blood now? Grania says. Or anyway, he's the one who's given the orders. I turn to Greta. Well, this changes things a bit, love. We can't start a grove here when we might have bloodsuckers coming after us. It wouldn't be safe. Her eyes flash at me and she shakes her head.
They'll be perfectly safe and you know it. They'll be inside a warded house at sundown and up at sunrise, all of them protected by us and their parents, and none of us easy to kill.
I don't know what grove you mean, but look at these stakes, son, Grania says. They can't be splintered or snapped, just like Scourger, and they have the unbinding for vampires carved right into them. Stab a vampire anywhere, left hand, right big toe, and they'll be unbound. You don't have to hit them in the heart with ease. I didn't know such a thing was possible. Neither did Lucta until he tried. Look, Braid wants the druids to win this time. These stakes were her idea, and Lucta made it happen. Braid's idea, eh? Well, we need to pay a visit to your mother in any case. We have to talk to her about starting a grove here, and maybe she knows where Sheehan is. I don't think she does. I brought all the stakes to you because we thought you would know where to find him.
I can try calling him,
Hal says, pulling out his cell phone. We watch in silence as he taps at the screen. He uses the speaker function so we can all hear, but the call goes straight to voicemail.
Nope. Either his phone's off, or it's dead, or he's not on this plane,
he says. Oh, I'll bet you he's on this plane, I growl, feeling the old ire swelling inside, when I know Sheehan's up to his shenanigans again. He's out there somewhere right now with his cheeky hound, doing something dumber than eating a bowl full of llama shite. I guarantee it.
Chapter 5. Purposefully seeking out a poltergeist might be one of the dumbest things I've ever done. Well, that and growing mutton chops. When I woke and checked the man in the mirror, the areas where I'd applied O'Sullivan's patented miracle beard tonic had outgrown the top half of my sideburns by about half an inch. That required some trimming. Then I had to flatten my hair down with some greasy goo, part it on the left, and plaster a curl of it on my forehead.
Well, that's different,
Oberon commented when I emerged from the bathroom.
I sure hope that style doesn't catch on with the world's poodles.
Can't believe it ever caught on with humans, I said, fetching my gray suit from the closet. It took me a couple of tries to get the tie looking right. It'd been a lifetime since I wore one. I took Oberon out for breakfast and a walk, during which he got admiring stares, and I got furtive, uncertain glances. The morning's newspaper declared that a strange rash of ritualistic murders had been carried out yesterday in America and Mexico, mostly in the Pacific time zone, where an alarming number of rich one percenters had been stabbed in the heart and then beheaded. The hammers of God had managed to score a few for the good guys, I saw. I set Oberon up in the room afterward with a Do Not Disturb sign and a food channel on the television. His favorite babysitter. He was currently into a show about strange foods from around the world. Strange, that is, to American tastes. He would tell me all about them and then demand to be taken to various destinations to try the live squid or the roasted locusts or whatever. I was careful to keep from him how worried I was about this operation. There were so many things that could go wrong, and I probably hadn't thought of them all. My hound was happy when I left him. Though highly amused by Americans trying the Korean dish called hongyo, or skate,
which is quite possibly the nastiest food in the world. My first stop was a used bookstore, where I found an old edition of the King James Bible with a red ribbon for a bookmark. I brought that with me instead of my sword, Frogara. Gwendolyn's fiancé knew nothing of swords, but had a thing for gospels. Then, there was no more time to waste. Werner Drosche was doubtless in Toronto by now and looking for me, so it was time to visit the Royal Conservatory of Music on Bloor Street, specifically Inatovich Hall, the modern, sponsored name of the old building where Gwendolyn had died in the 19th century and become the Lady in Red, and where, some 70 years later, she had mistaken me for her fiancé, Nigel. Once I walked into the building, a funny thing happened. People stopped staring at me as if I were a walking fashion faux pas and smiled at me instead. In the music world, eccentric dress was a marker of genius, or something.
"Must be a pianist,"
I heard one student whisper to another as they passed me on the grand staircase.
"Oh, he's got to be a cellist,"
the other whispered back.
"They're all bug fuck."
The building had far fewer unoccupied rooms than in the fall of 1953. People were practicing in them or taking in musical theory lectures and living a blissful life of art and chair politics in whatever orchestra or symphony they belonged to. And many of the smaller rooms were faculty offices now. There was nothing available on the second floor where Gwendolyn originally found me, so I climbed the stairs to the third floor and found an unoccupied classroom. The number of desks that could be tossed at me was unsettling, but I chose one near the door and knelt down next to it, Bible in hand, and spoke aloud.
"Gwendolyn, it's me, Nigel. I would like to speak with you, please."
I kept going on in that vein for a long while, repeating my name and hers and my wish to speak. My knees began to throb after an hour, and I considered that perhaps Gwendolyn had moved on. It would hardly be surprising. What would keep her lingering here after the supposed betrayal she'd suffered?
"Well,"
I said, getting to my feet,
"I just wanted to say I'm sorry."
"Sorry for what?"
an ethereal voice whispered. And there, across the room, a red vision floated above the professor's lectern.
"Sorry I wasn't there for you when you needed me, when you were trampled by that horse in the street."
"That is all?"
"I've never forgiven myself for that. Your death could have been prevented if I'd only come out to meet you."
"And what about the other woman?"
"What? There is no other woman. There never has been and never will be."
"I saw you, Nigel. I saw you with her."
Furniture shifted around, scraping against the tile. I was going to be bombarded with flying desks soon. Before that became too much to bear, I had to convince her that she hadn't seen her Nigel with another woman, for she truly hadn't. He'd been faithful to her, as far as I could discover from my historical research. My plan relied on the idea that ghosts have one thing in common with hounds. They're not too clear on the passage of time. As far as Gwendolyn was concerned, Nigel was not only still alive, he was still attending his Baptist seminary in the 19th century. Things like cars driving on paved roads outside and electricity inside, those simply didn't penetrate whatever consciousness she had. The only thing that mattered to her was her relationship with Nigel, which was probably why she ignored or simply did not see minor differences in our appearance and voice. If she was ever to have a chance of moving on, she needed to repair that relationship with Nigel and get a sense of closure. So, now, I had to be the man himself.
I don't know what you saw, Gwendolyn, but whoever it wasn't me. I would never do that to you. There is a lad here at the college who looks a lot like me, though. Maybe you mistook him for me.
No, it was you. You were wearing that suit. She kept saying your name. She called you Nigel.
Desks levitated off the floor, twitching and spinning, and one of them rocketed at my head as I shouted a desperate response and ducked. It still clipped me painfully on the forearm I had raised to protect my head.
Ugh. Gray suits are common as corn, Gwendolyn, and whoever the woman was that you saw called him Nigel, not me. Did he say his name was Nigel?
That made her pause, and she forgot about the desks, allowing gravity to pull them down to the floor again with a crash.
No.
What did he say his name was?
He didn't. Just that it wasn't Nigel.
Well, there you have it.
Then why did she call him that?
I haven't the slightest notion. People do strange things, Gwen. I have heard, I wouldn't know, of course, that some people enjoy role-playing. Perhaps that was what you stumbled across.
Role-playing?
That was a rabbit hole I didn't want to explore, especially since I was playing a role at that very moment, so I hurried past it.
Yes, I am so very sorry that you have been plagued with doubts, but it gives me so much joy to see you again.
Joy, seeing me like this? Do you not think me damned?
She said.
Not at all, I replied, which I knew had to be the right answer. One hardly tells one's fiancée that she's damned. But then I had to think of why that would be so. Traditionally, a ghost would be at minimum cursed, if not damned, in the eyes of a Protestant minister, provided that a minister believed his eyes. But then I recalled that spiritualism was quite popular in the Victorian era, and was bound to have some influence on the Nigel of the past. The idea that spirits not only could communicate with the living, but were predisposed to do so. Nigel hadn't been a black-clad Puritan, and he wasn't some modern fundamentalist. He'd been a product of his time.
You're just waiting before you move on. You still have something to do here, something to teach me, or to teach us all. And I want to help you, Gwendolyn.
How?
The man who ran you down. I know where to find him. He needs to be stopped before he hurts anyone else with his carelessness.
I don't want revenge.
No, no, me neither. This is simple justice and peace of mind. I worry about who else he might hurt. You can leave this place, right?
Yes. But I don't want to leave. I want to talk to you.
And I want to talk to you. But I think it's important to stop this man first, and then we can talk all you want.
She nodded her agreement, and then I held up a finger.
Just one moment while I make arrangements. Wait here for me for a small while.
I will wait. I have been waiting already.
I'll be right outside the door and return for you as soon as possible.
I grinned at her as I climbed to my feet and scooted for the door. Once in the hallway, I turned on my cell phone and immediately got pinged with missed calls. One of them was from Hal Houck, my attorney, with whom I wished to speak anyway, so I thumbed the callback button.
Atticus, where are you?
He said. Toronto, look, Hal, I need you to get a hold of Leaf and ask him for Werner Drosch's number.
What?
You can still get in touch with Leaf, can't you?
Yes, but who's this Werner Drosch?
Long story. I just need his number right away, okay?
Okay, but we've been trying to get a hold of you regarding something else. Your Arc Druid wants to start a grove up near Flagstaff, take on 6 apprentices.
Apprentices? Where'd he find them?
I found them. They're the children of pack members, born before their parents were turned.
Sounds perfect. except that things are going to be warming up on the vampire front. You all should look out. Take precautions.
Were you responsible for this morning's headlines?
Yeah, that was me. Or sort of me. Remember that guy in my shop with the beard who tried to throw a silver knife at you that one time?
Oh, yes, that odd rabbi.
He's much more calm now. It was his organization that did all that last night, using information I gave them. I'm moving fast and ambushing them as much as possible, but they're going to catch up with me eventually. There could be blowback, especially after today, so you guys should watch out.
Thanks for the warning.
A familiar, growly voice shouted in the background of the call. Al said,
Your arch-druid says to meet him in Tir na n'og at the Fae Court. He has something for you.
All right, I will, but I have things to do here first. Werner Drosh's number?
Call you back soon.
It was only 5 minutes of agonizing waiting in the old chapel before Hal called back with Drosh's number and gave me Leif's as well for future reference.
Leif is only too glad to cooperate,
he said.
Said to tell you to carry on. You're doing well.
Gods below, he's a smug bastard.
What's he talking about?
I'll have to tell you later. Clock's ticking. We rang off, and I dialed the number for the arcane life leech. He picked up immediately and answered in German. I replied in English. Hello, Werner. It's your favorite druid.
O'Sullivan, where are you?
Probably not that far from you if you're in Toronto.
I am. Your little stunt will not do you any more good. I've sent notice that everyone should move.
You must be very popular among the vampires right now. What with compromising their security and making them lug their coffins around? And all those staked vampires on the West Coast. Woo! Your people will be scrambling around to keep the reports on all those autopsies secret.
He cursed in German. That witch in Africa said you'd never return to Toronto.
Makira was a tyromancer, not a witch, but Drasha probably would not care about the distinction. She told you the truth as best as she could see it.
I'm just unpredictable.
We have that in common, Werner. When you killed my friend Kodiak Black, you left a note that said you wanted to talk, yet all you did in Ethiopia was spray bullets at me. That's uncommon rudeness, Werner. Especially when I spared your life the first time we met.
You want to talk? We're talking now.
It's not good enough, somehow. Let's do it in person.
I have something to say to your face, and I bet you're wearing a fabulous ascot today.
Meet me in Massey Hall on the corner of Victoria and Shooter in a half hour. I'll be inside. I disconnected before he could reply. Whether he came alone or with a bunch of hired muscle, the people of Toronto would be safe. He couldn't leech anything from an empty theater. I ducked my head back into the classroom and saw Gwendolyn still hovering there, a vision in red.
Everything's settled. Shall we go?
I extended a hand to her, and she floated toward me. Something approaching a smile curving the slash of a mouth on her face. We descended the grand staircase together, and the single person we saw on the way froze for a second, and then hurried up past us without saying a word. When we stepped outside into the sunlight on the steps where she died, I paused to look at her.
Ready? I'm ready, Nigel,
she said, though her voice was a faint whisper in the daylight, and she looked like someone had gotten too enthusiastic with the transparency slider.
Excellent. Please don't trouble yourself about these roads and the strange carriages and clothing people wear. There have been a few changes since you passed. Progress.
She made no answer, and it was just as well. I had to worry instead about other people troubling themselves about the red apparition floating next to me. Perhaps I would get lucky, I thought, and I'd be the only one who could see her. That didn't happen. I was hailed twice on the brisk walk to Massey Hall, once by a pedestrian and once by someone in a car, and asked what was that red smudge next to me.
What? I asked. I don't see anything.
that got rid of them. They would no doubt make optometrist appointments soon. Massey Hall was a dirty brick lump of a building on the outside, covered in soot and grime reminiscent of buildings from the Industrial Revolution. Fire escape stairwells on the front of the building, intended to give people on the balcony a fleeting chance in case of disaster, sloped down to the left and right, bracketing the front doors in an iron triangle. Three double doors with small windows above them were painted candy apple red to reassure everyone that the building wasn't derelict and promised all kinds of fun inside. The inside was a beautiful theater with excellent acoustics, which was why everyone put up with the ugly outside. And like most theaters, it's spectacularly empty during the day, making it an excellent place for a tete-a-tete in the middle of a huge city. Drasha would appreciate that I'd be cut off from the earth. It would be a fair fight, or appear so to him as he walked into an ambush. And it was fine if he suspected an ambush. Short of demolishing the building with me inside, there would be nothing he could do, and I hoped the half-hour window to act would prevent him from orchestrating something like that.
"The man who ran you down,"
I said to Gwendolyn,
"is bald and has strange tattoos all over his head. I want to talk to him alone inside this building. If anyone else tries to enter the building, from any door on any side, please keep them out as best you can. Close and lock the doors. Toss them across the street, whatever it takes. Just get the bald, tattooed man in and keep everyone else out."
"Very well."
"Can you lock and unlock these doors?"
I asked, pointing to the first pair. "Best to make sure."
"Yes."
"Would you please unlock one for me?"
She could do it faster than I could by flipping the tumblers, and I didn't want to use any of my stored energy if I didn't have to. Once they clacked, I pulled open the door.
"Thanks, Gwendolyn. You can leave this one open until the bald man comes inside. He shouldn't be long."
If he was the punctual sort, anyway. It had taken most of a half hour to walk from the conservatory to the concert hall, and that was a nervous speed walk.
"Be careful, Nigel,"
she said. "Thank you. I will."
I had to cast night vision once inside and find the light board. It took me a couple of minutes to figure out how to bring up the house lights, but once I did, I returned to the main seating area and shuffled sideways down the 12th row of seats. In the middle of it, I crouched down on the floor, which was a bit cramped, but kept my head out of sight. I took off my confining shoes with a sigh of relief. Drasha burst through the doors in the back of the theater moments later, shouting my name.
"Where are you? Let's have that talk!"
Casting camouflage and beginning the drain of my bear charm, I peeked above the chair backs to locate him. His suit was a somber, slim-cut black for a change, but he'd come through on the ascot with the glowing shade of teal that qualified as optic assault. Hands clasped behind his back, he scanned the theater for me, and his eyes flicked up to the low ceiling directly above him, which was the floor of the balcony. He probably wondered if I was up there, and he hesitated before stepping out from under it, not wishing to give me a free shot at him if I was waiting above.
"Talk to me, Druid. What is it you wish to say?"
I whispered a simple binding to see if he'd learned anything from our first meeting on the beach in France, and discovered that he had. All his clothing was synthetic fiber now, nothing natural for me to bind.
"You're an abomination and a threat to all life,"
I called, and his head swiveled in the direction of my voice, trying in vain to spy me.
"And since you did nothing positive with your life once I spared it, I need to rethink my mercy."
I put the sole of my foot on a metal seat back, which was bolted to the floor, and under which I knew Ferris, the iron elemental, lurked. I didn't feel the buzz of him immediately underneath me, but he had to be nearby. He was still waiting for his treat after yesterday's heist.
"Man with magic in his skin,"
I sent to him through the metal. "It is yours now."
"Yes, my mercy,"
Drasha said, and he brought his hands forward with automatic weapons in each hand, little machine guns with huge clips curving down from the handle. He pointed them in my general direction, and his fingers held down the triggers. Steel-jacketed bullets zinged and popped off the theater seats, and I ducked down, lying flat in the aisle and maintaining my camouflage. Lots of bullets was Drasha's answer to Druidry, and it was why I hadn't bothered bringing Fragora. You don't bring a sword to a gunfight. Unfortunately, Drasha didn't need to see me to hit me. With all the ordnance he was throwing around, it was only a matter of time. Seconds, in fact, until one of them ricocheted off the metal seats and nailed me. I felt it plunge into my back and perforate my liver. I grunted involuntarily, dropped my camouflage, and triggered the healing charm instead, hoping a single bullet would be all I had to deal with. But I heard him run out, reload, and start up again, and he must have heard me grunt, because this time he zeroed in on my row and the next one down. One burst got me four times when it hit the chairs behind me, two in the same area of my back, one ripping low through my guts, another that missed my spleen and got my pancreas instead, and two more that tore through the hamstrings of my right leg. When he ran out of ammunition for the second time, and I heard him reload once more, I dug into my pocket for my phone. I was rapidly running out of juice dealing with my wounds, and wouldn't make it without help. It was all I could do to stop the internal bleeding and knit my stomach back up before the acids leaked out and dissolved my intestines. If I died here cut off from Gaia, there'd be no save from my soul catcher. Drasha got off perhaps 10 rounds from his fresh clips before Ferris finally emerged from the floor, much later than I would have wished, but very hungry.
"Was ist das?"
he said in German.
"Nein!"
I had to see this, so I risked levering myself up on my left arm and poking my head out in plain sight, gasping in pain as I did so. Drasha didn't put a bullet in my head because he wasn't looking in my direction anymore. He was staring at his pointy-toed boots and dancing around as a furry black collection of iron shavings crawled up his legs and torso, traveling up to his head.
"Oh, Sullivan!"
he shouted, dropping his guns and frantically brushing at the flowing iron, which ignored his efforts and continued upward.
"What is this?"
"That's Ferris," I said. "Never bring a gun to an elemental fight, Drasha." Ferris reached the alchemical tattoos on Drasha's scalp and cheeks, arcane sigils that gave him the power to leech energy directly from living things, as long as he had line of sight. And then the iron elemental began to feed on the raw magic imbued in the symbols. Judging by the sounds Drasha made, it was not a painless process. His attempts to repel Ferris were fruitless. The furry iron flowed like water around and under his fingers. I smiled faintly as I sank back to the floor and dialed 911. The screaming in the background would provide some urgency, I hoped, to the ambulance and the police. The operator tried to ask questions about what she was hearing, but I thumbed off the connection once she knew the location and that I'd been shot. A dull thud suggested that the life leech had collapsed to the ground, but I didn't worry about his health. Ferris wouldn't kill him. He couldn't, because that would be breaking the rules Gaia set down for elementals. He'd merely turn Verna Drasha from a monster to a human with monstrous proclivities. I was far more worried about myself. The energy in my bear charm ran dry, overtaxed by the demands of healing, and further evidence that I should really make another 10 or so, leaving me with 5 gunshot wounds, a wave of pain, and a fine start on a case of shock. When my vision turned red, I thought I was on the verge of blacking out, but it turned out to be Gwendolyn floating above me.
"Nigel, you're hurt,"
her whispery voice breathed.
"Yes, the blackguard shot me, but paramedics, I mean a doctor, is on the way."
She wouldn't know what a paramedic was.
"No, I'm not sure he'll be in time."
Her pale, smudged face turned to where Drasha writhed and screamed in the aisle.
"What is happening to him?"
she asked. I didn't know how to explain Ferris to her, so I said,
"Justice.
Are there any more men outside?
No, he came alone. He should die.
Her fists clenched at her sides, and her eyes lit up with rage.
No, no, Gwendolyn, listen to me,
I said, realizing that this was my chance to set her free.
He is getting what he deserves now, and will get more when he arrives in hell. Do not tarnish your soul with violence. It is time for you to move on.
As it is time for me.
Go on, and wait for me, Gwendolyn. I'll be there soon, and we can be together again.
Her head turned back to regard me, and the signs of anger fell away. All her edges softened, and she made a noise somewhere between a sigh and a coo. The ghost swooped down until she was a mere inch above me, and I shivered from the chill of her proximity.
I love you, Nigel.
I love you too, Gwendolyn,
I said, hoping it would be enough to soothe her restless spirit.
Always. Go on now, and I'll join you very soon.
Soon,
she said, slowly rising and then dissipating in wisps of red until all I could see was the ceiling of the theater.
Farewell,
I whispered, hoping that wherever she went, she would find the real Nigel waiting for her. Werner Drosche's screams wound down to moans, and eventually whimpers in German. And I might have let loose a moan or two of my own. When Ferris finished with the life leech, he thanked me before leaving.
Delicious,
he said. Thanks for your help earlier, I replied, since he could do nothing else for me, and he melted away, leaving me to shiver in silent pain and hope I didn't bleed out before help arrived, or that Drosche wouldn't summon the strength to grab one of his guns and crawl down here to finish me off. Apart from getting shot, it had been a couple of good days in Toronto, though to be truthful, almost any day would be good in comparison to getting shot. Still, I had enlisted the hammers of God in the world's biggest vampire hunt, stripped Werner Drosche of his powers, and sent a long-suffering ghost to her rest. It would be a good story to tell Oberon.
Oh, gods below! Oberon! He was still in the hotel room, and I wouldn't be getting back to him anytime soon. He was also much too far away for me to reach via our mental bond, so he'd be worried.
I thought of calling Hal, since I didn't know where Granuel was, but didn't want to remind Drosche that I was still alive. I silenced the phone and texted him instead. Shot in Toronto. Need someone to take care of Oberon in hotel. Send Owen, maybe? I added the hotel info and sent it. In a few seconds, I got a glorious, if terse, reply.
On it.
O'Sullivan!
Drosha's voice grated.
What did you do to me?
I made no answer, and tried to breathe as quietly as possible. The lack of damage to my lungs kept me from coughing, at least. The acoustics of the theater allowed me to hear the rasping of cloth on carpet as Drosche dragged himself down the aisle and a wet hand slapping against the metal of a gun.
Going to make verdammt sure you are dead,
he growled. There was nothing I could do. I had all the mobility and martial capability of a soggy sponge, and the same magical ability as he did. That is, none whatsoever. He must have picked up only one of his guns because I heard him begin to crawl in my direction, and the gun made a clacking noise at odd intervals when his hand came down. He grew closer and closer. And the sound reminded me of that final sequence of The Terminator where the robot dragged itself after Sarah Connor, except that she could move a little bit and had some handy machinery around to crush her pursuer.
Ah, there you are,
I stretched my neck, looked to the end of the aisle, and saw Werner Drosche peering back at me. His eyeballs gleamed abnormally white and mad in a puffy red face with little pinpricks of blood dotting it, and plenty more smeared around where he had tried to shoo Ferris away. The ink of the alchemical tattoos still remained, but the magic infused with them was gone, and he still didn't realize it. He knew from experience that he couldn't leech any energy.